breakfast, December, it's an annual tradition. We have an ethics presentation, so you get that EPR credit for free. Jack is always willing to put an outline together and lead the discussion of these issues, and we hope it is a discussion, not just a lecture. Mike Maloney's here with him today to offer his perspective and some thoughts to throw out. We have cookies here by my wonderful judicial assistant, Paula. She and her mom bake a big array of Christmas cookies every year, and she's got a sample back there. Please take some. They're fresh, they're wonderful, and we appreciate her doing that for our December presentation every year. Coming up, January 8th, Ryan Blay and Anton Nicolai on reaffirmations, redemptions, and surrenders in Chapter 7. And then February 12th, we have Beth Brockmeyer and Dayton Hansen on issues for high-income debtors. So those are the next two things. We've also got some other things cooking. Check the website. You'll see what's coming up. If you're interested in presenting a topic, or you have a topic that you want to hear about, give Ryan Blay a call. He's the guy coming up this year that's going to be coordinating the speakers. So if you want to hear about a topic, talk to Ryan. If you're willing to present on the topic, fabulous. We'd love to have you talk to Ryan. Again, check the website, talk to Paula. In the remote locations, please send in or email. I don't know how you guys get your info to Paula so that she can get your credit, CLE credit, all fixed up for you. Thanks again for coming, everybody. Thanks, Jack and Mike.
All right. Good morning, everybody, and again, thank you for coming. I know sometimes on Tuesday mornings it's hard for people to get here because of all the Chapter 13 hearings we have, and it's early, and we're here on a boring topic like ethics. Mike and I are going to try to make it a little bit more interesting. We're going to try to relate some ethical rules to actual bankruptcy practice. And the first situation that we're going to start with, it's actually a fact pattern that was posted on the Biker listserv this past October. It's similar to the situation that Judge Pepper and Dave Kreckler acted out at the annual update this past year, in that it has to do with an undisclosed asset. But I think the fact that this problem was actually posted on the listserv shows that ethical dilemmas do come up in practice. They're not just academic exercises, and they bring up difficult situations with difficult questions that we have to answer. For example, do you as an attorney have to blow the whistle on your client, or is there no mandatory requirement? Should you blow the whistle? And if you are disclosing something that your client doesn't want you to, are you breaching the duty of confidentiality? So the facts that we have here are a debtor who is represented by counsel files a Chapter 7 case. On his schedules, the debtor lists a vehicle valued at $20,000 with a $20,000 lien on it. The debtor receives a discharge. About a year after discharge, the debtor's attorney discovers that the lien was not properly perfected. And for some reason, nobody noticed this before. The Chapter 7 trustee didn't catch it. Whatever, it comes up, like I said, a year after discharge. So the attorney discusses the situation with his client or his former client, and
this must be in the Western District because I'm sure all our trustees would catch this.
Must be.
Oh boy.
So the attorney has a discussion with his client and you know, says, well, you know, the right thing to do is probably to disclose this. And the client says, no, I don't want to. I got my discharge. It wasn't my fault. I didn't know about it. You know, that creditor screwed up. And we now have the question, does the attorney have an obligation to notify the Chapter 7 trustee? Because the problem is that had the trustee known about the lien that wasn't perfected, he would have avoided the lien, sold the car, and paid the proceeds to creditors. So who here thinks that the attorney does not have a duty to disclose? Okay.
Well, why would the attorney have a duty to disclose?
Well, I think there's a few rules that we need to look at to get to that reason. I think that there is a duty personally. We got to look at rules 1.6 and 3.3, and I have them in the boxed area of the outline. So if we look at rule 1.6A generally, it says a lawyer shall not reveal any information related to the representation of a client. However, if we move to the next section, 1.6B, that's the mandatory reporting section. And it says that a lawyer shall reveal information relating to the representation of a client to the extent that the lawyer believes is necessary to prevent the client from committing a criminal or fraudulent act that the lawyer reasonably believes is likely to result in substantial injury to the financial interest or property of another. Okay, so because this this section starts out with shall, it says a lawyer shall reveal, it's mandatory reporting. However, I'm not so sure this is the section that applies here to these facts. The client didn't really commit any fraud. This was a mistake by the creditor not properly perfecting a lien. I guess it could be argued that once the debtor finds out about the problem with the perfection and not doing anything about it, perhaps that could be construed as fraud.
You can't have fraud way after the fact, right? Doesn't fraud include some level of knowing or intent?
Well, I think that's an argument. I mean, at the point where the debtor finds out that there's...
But the case is closed, right? So don't you have a problem with three words? Prevent, criminal, and fraudulent. You probably don't have a crime, you probably don't have a fraud, and you can't prevent it because it's already done.
Well, I think there's more problems with B than that, yeah. B also says that the lawyer reasonably believes is likely to result. So the action already happened. Whatever happened here. And I think finally, if the section were construed to be applicable here, we need to determine whether the financial interests of creditors would be substantially injured. So, I mean, you got to look at things where, you know, were there 50 creditors here who would have received $400 each, or were there two creditors here who would have received $10,000 each? You know, and I think that goes to determination of whether the injury was substantial. The next section that may be applicable here is 1.6C. It's on the same page. And that section basically says a lawyer may reveal information to mitigate or rectify substantial injury to the financial interest of another that has resulted from the client's commission of a crime or fraud in furtherance of which the client has used the lawyer's services. Again, we have that problem of, is there fraud or a crime here? Probably not. Ryan?
Do you think the information on the bankruptcy schedule is even confidential? Is being used to disclose everything in the bankruptcy court?
I don't think so, because they're public information. They're part of the public record.
So do we even need to analyze 1.6, or is that just an extra protection?
Well, I think what the attorney is grappling with, the problem is that there is an unperfected lien, and nobody knows about it, and whether the Chapter 7 trustee should, you know, find out about that at this point. But here, what I think gets the attorney is section 3.3, candor toward the tribunal.
Is there an ethical problem with people coming to an ethics seminar late?
There might be.
You know, actually, when I look at this one, I think this is one of the hard ones. And I understand Ryan saying a lot of stuff on the schedules makes it in the public view, so it's not really bound by the confidentiality rules. I know there's a decision out there regarding that recently in a different state. The bigger problem here is there's nothing wrong on the schedules. I mean, technically, if it's a disclosure of the lien on D, it's still on D, even if it's unperfected. You would still list on D. There's nothing wrong in the schedules anywhere. The schedules were correct. You're always going to have a hard time whenever you're trying to convince lawyers that we need to do something to go against our confidentiality, because that's probably one of the biggest ones we have in the ethical rules, is our duty of confidentiality. So unless it's really crystal clear that you have to do it, I'm almost on the side of having to err on the side of the confidentiality. In this particular case, with this fact scenario, as I look at it, this isn't a fraud, it isn't a crime, I'm not preventing anything from happening. On this one, I would probably, I mean, this isn't the debtor who's like, oh yeah, I had $1 million in the bank and I hid it from you and I tell you about it later on, where you're like, whoa. This is one where the debtor actually went through with totally clean hands. They probably don't even know what this is. The bigger question for me when I looked at it was, talk to your client, because it probably is in their best interest if we avoid the lien. When Chapter 7 trustees take car liens, those are usually good things for our clients, because we can now buy the lien from the trustee, and oftentimes at a substantial discount. So, I mean, in this particular fact scenario, if the client's absolutely adamant, the first thing you have to do is talk to your client and explain where you're at and what's going to happen, and maybe get the end result set up before you even have to decide. But when it comes to confidentiality on this one, I couldn't see myself going and doing it.
Judge McGarity? Yeah, and here, I guess part of the facts are that the trustee just didn't catch it, but the debtor's attorney did a year after discharge.
Right, and so clients didn't do anything. The trustee. How much duty do you have to disclose to the trustee, hey, you've got an advantage over me, you better take it. And that can come up all over.
That's why Trustee Dubas is a smart one. At the 341s, he asks you, do you have any unexempt assets or unperfected liens? And he gets the lawyer to answer that question at the 341.
There's now a growing trend. We had a discussion about this at our annual trustee meeting. There's a growing trend for trustees to ask the lawyer, is this a case that there are any assets available for creditors? Now, that brings up all sorts of ethical issues. Because, and I know Dubas is starting to do this, he says to the lawyer, are there any unprotected assets? Are there any lien issues here? Then that's even more interesting, because then the lawyer isn't under oath, but they have a duty to answer honestly. So it does kind of follow up on what Justin said. Where does it stop?
Do they have a duty to answer at all? Now, if they answer that, they answer honestly, but why answer the question?
What are you going to say? I'm not going to answer the question. Well, then that's
what how about, I'm not going to answer the question, and then attorney or trustee Dubas or whoever can do his work. It's still his responsibility. I mean, you want to ask my client that question? My client will answer, but I won't answer.
Well, if the counsel has said to their debtor client, you have a tax refund that's unprotected, or your lien wasn't perfected on your car, and the trustee then asks the debtor, I suppose that's the way around that.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I've always answered it, because I'm not trying to slide anything past the trustee. If I have an asset, I already know I have the asset. I'm assuming we're giving it to the trustee. Or if I have an unperfected lien, I'm going, hey, take this. We're all set up. Let us know. Here comes, you know, we're already three steps down the road. So, for me, it's mostly a non-issue, but it does bring into question the fact of, if you said no and then you have this fact scenario, well, now you bring in candor to the tribunal and knowingly false statements by counsel, so that becomes a little bit different.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. If we look at 3.3, I think this is what requires disclosure. I think it applies more than 1.6 does. generally 3.3 says a lawyer shall not knowingly fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by a lawyer. And that's A1. So the petition schedules were filed by an attorney on behalf of a debtor. So I think schedules are construed as statements made to the court. And I think if a lawyer finds out that there's a material misstatement on there, being that there's a lien that, unperfected lien that wasn't disclosed, that needs to be corrected. Jay?
Well, there's a year between a perfection in a lien and a secured creditor. The creditor is still a secured creditor and should be listed on Schedule D. The perfection issue is completely different, and there's no space on the form that says, did the creditor fail to perfect their security?
So the schedules would be correct.
The schedules are correct, yeah.
Yeah, the schedules would be correct.
Well, the lawyer is the one presenting the schedules to the court. I know the debtor signs them under penalty of perjury.
Jack, what does it make any difference in this case if the debtor had gone and reaffirmed the debt? Where do you stand then? Would the debtor thought it was a protective reason?
I don't think so. Would that be a valid reaffirmation?
Well, I mean, the lien's valid against the debtor, whether it's perfected or not perfected. The only one who can avoid it would be the trustee. So if the debtor reaffirmed the debt, they reaffirm the ability to come after them personally. The in rem right versus them was always okay, even if it was unperfected. So maybe that's the reason why the debtor doesn't want you to go back to the trustee, because they may have this reaffirmed debt out there, and going back in and stripping the lien may leave them with just a huge unsecured debt, maybe.
Okay. Well, as you can see, I don't think the answer is clear. I mean, in this type of situation, I think, what Mike pointed out before, if this was a situation where prior to discharge, the debtor's attorney found out that his client had $2 million in an offshore account and didn't want to disclose that, I think there'd be a disclosure requirement under 1.6, and that would be clear. But with these facts, I don't think the answer is very clear. And I should point out that if you practice in another state, every state has adopted the ABA model rules of ethics. And I think every state besides California, but every state puts their own spin on them. In Wisconsin, Wisconsin has mandatory language in Rule 1.6B, which the ABA model rules doesn't have. I think the ABA model rule says may, not shall disclose. Similarly, Rule 3.3, in the ABA, it says that a debtor's remedial measures duty expires at the conclusion of the proceeding. Wisconsin doesn't have that expiration. So even if the proceeding is over, the attorney's duty runs. Do you want to move on to unbundling?
Sure. Next section was on unbundling of legal fees. This has had a little bit within the last year. We've had a court decision that came out that talked about this. We've had extensive conversations among everybody in the room about what is your scope of representation when you're dealing with debtors. You have to pretty much unbundle some legal fees if you're practicing bankruptcy on the consumer side. The difficult part with that is determining how to give informed consent to your client so that your client can actually understand, here's what I'm doing for you and here's what I'm not doing for you. The reason I say that is that you can't sign yourself up for every non-dischargeability adversary and trial for your standard fee on what you would consider to be a no-asset Chapter 7 bankruptcy. You would have to set up a system where you can get paid separately for long protracted litigation. But you have to be able to explain to your client in a way that, hey, if someone comes after you and says you did terrible things, then that shouldn't go away, you're going to have to hire me again to fight that. I'm just doing the bankruptcy part. The other interesting part that comes up is that...
Mike, let me interrupt. Agreements like that are generally accepted in this district, right?
I believe most attorneys do keep them separate for the most part. I know that regardless of that, we all still, by local rule, are the attorney of record on adversaries when they're filed, if you were the attorney of record under the original case. And then you have to actually withdraw. But limiting scope of practice
is... You can withdraw by stipulation and proposed order, right? You don't have to file a motion with notice and a hearing.
I mean, I think I usually just file a motion. I mean, I've gotten to the point with the Chapter 13s, with the run-of-the-mill adversaries, like the DWD adversaries, I'm just representing the debtor on them. They're usually fairly simple. It's more difficult to try and get out than it is to just get through it. You're not going to go to trial on those cases. They're pretty slam dunk. The state has the evidence. They have everything, and your client touched the phone wrong. So it's one of those things that I'm just representing on those lately. In terms of the large ones, realistically, before you start, you should know when your client's going to have a huge mess. I mean, you can't always tell when your client's going to have a huge mess, but you should kind of know, hey, this guy used to be a roofer. Do you have anybody who's really mad that you do bad roofs? Yes. Okay, if they show up, I'm not stopping that. You know, contractors, I mean, you just know certain types of people are going to show up. Give them the long speech before they hire you. Put it in the contract clean as day. And then when they come in, have them, they'll call you and they'll say, are you going to take care of this for me? You go, well, we talked about that before and here's where we're at and my hourly rate is this and you can pay me a retainer and here's three names of three other people that love doing this kind of stuff. So decide what you want to do. But, it just comes down to the beginning where you got to kind of know what it is. I mean, it even goes to the last one. You should kind of have your case set up before you start. I mean, you kind of know where most of the stuff's going. I mean, obviously you can get ambushed if some client gets to the 341 and suddenly testifies, yeah, I had a different Social Security number and I've been getting all kinds of bills from everywhere. I mean, but at that point you got to just explain it. There's really not much to talk about with that. But the next one is that we talk about oftentimes is, and we've seen a little bit, is some attorneys across the country have tried unbundling the actual bankruptcy itself from either just giving advice before you file, just a pre-bankruptcy advice session, to filing the schedules but unbundling the
creditors. That would be considered unreasonable. I think the ethical rule in Wisconsin says you can unbundle your legal fees as long as the unbundling is reasonable under the circumstances and the client gives informed consent. And I think it becomes a problem when if an attorney says something like, you know, I'll counsel you in the beginning part of your case, guide you to which chapter you should file, and that's it. After this, you're on your own. You go to the 341 meeting. I'm not representing you on anything else. I don't think that would fly.
I mean, I think a lot of it, though, too, has to, and this is bad, but it requires the sophistication of your client. I mean, if I have a business client that comes in here and he's got a business and he says business isn't going good, we better start looking at things in terms of what am I going to be able to get rid of, what am I not going to be able to get rid of, and setting things up. And he just wants advice of, can I even go 13? You know, and he comes in, he pays you some money to figure out, can I go Chapter 13, or am I over the debt limits, or something like that, or what assets do I stand to lose in Chapter 7 if I go personally bankrupt? I think you can unbundle that from actually filing a bankruptcy, because that's not what he hired you for. He didn't hire you to file a bankruptcy. Where it gets more difficult is when you're dealing with the prototypical pro se help desk person, and you start trying to say, I'm going to just do A, and then you're going to file pro se, or you're going to do your own thing by yourself, or you're going to go to a different lawyer. They have a really hard time grasping. Once you're their lawyer, they think you're their lawyer forever. I mean, 10 years later, they'll call you and say, you're my lawyer, I have this problem, my sister stole my car. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you have to really be careful of, is that in order to give informed consent, they actually have to be capable of giving you informed consent as well. So I think the reason the reasonableness standard, that's way too big of a word. The reasonable standard has to do with the client as much as it does with the services as well sometimes. That's my take. What do you think?
You are going to try that, and we have attorneys who try it. The pre-petition services are one contract, and the post-petition services are another contract. You have to have two contracts, and you have to disclose that in the
2016.
You have to disclose that. Your 2016 is the place to show this is what we've agreed to, and don't have that be all kind of ambiguous and try to hide the ball. If you're going to try to do this, disclose it, and we'll figure out if it's kosher or not.
I mean, the one I've always been apprehensive or worried about on those ones, though, too, is what happens if the senator doesn't want to sign the second contract after you file it. Then you get in the situation where, Jack said, it's unreasonable to tear off the 341 from the initial filing. So now what do you do? Because theoretically, you're supposed to have the client sign one contract before bankruptcy and one contract after bankruptcy for the after stuff. If the client doesn't want to sign the after one, you've gotten yourself into the pickle, basically. I don't know. That's why I haven't done it, but that's why I don't do it. But.
Oh, I was going to ask you, has that ever happened?
No, I don't do it. I get all my fees up front. It's just too dangerous in my mind to play with it where I can get put in a position where I file the schedules and I say, okay, now you got to hire me and pay me later on to do the 341, and they go, no. Okay, well, that's not good. So, I mean, that becomes a potential ethical dilemma that you can trap yourself in my idea.
Okay. So normally, in a Chapter 7, for example, if you had a fee agreement that says, I'm going to represent you up through the conclusion of the 341 meeting of creditors, do you think that would be okay without having a second contract?
If you get paid out, this has to do more with the fees, really, because... how you get paid is the difficult part. If you get paid all of your money before you file bankruptcy, you're going to be fine as long as you say, I'm going to represent you all the way through the 341, and then that's where my services stop. You're going to be okay. What gets tricky is when you're going to say, I'm going to take half my money or three-quarters of my money before I file for these two meetings to file a case. Then you file the case, and you come back and go, okay, now do you want me to represent you for this work? And then they can enter into a separate agreement for this work and pay you for the work that you do after you file the bankruptcy. Courts that have looked at it have said it's okay if you have separate fee agreements for the post-petition work. As long as you're getting paid post-petition for post-petition work and pre-petition for pre-petition work, you're fine. My concern was always you have to sign the second contract after you filed the bankruptcy, or it was basically rejected when you filed the bankruptcy. Or you owed the debt when you filed the bankruptcy and there is no debt anymore. So you have to sign it after you file the bankruptcy, and then you get yourself in this quandary of what do you do with the client who doesn't do it.
Yeah.
I think it's a low risk because most clients want you at the 341 because they'd be scared to death to go there by themselves, but...
Yeah, and you know what? I think it probably is a low risk that they won't sign that second contract, because from what I heard is, you'll be sitting with your client, you'll have the computer in front of you, file the petition. Right after it's filed, you just... hand them their second agreement, and
but you have a duty to inform them what they're signing and why they're signing
well,
it too.
I mean,
you can't just say, okay, now sign this one. they have to understand what they're signing.
The other consideration is the filing fee. You get all these folks wanting to pay that filing fee in installments. If you can't pay an attorney or any money else and get them in connection with the bankruptcy case until the filing fee is paid. So if you're doing this pre-petition and post-petition contract, you can't get paid on that post-petition contract until their filing fee is paid.
Yeah, that's a good point. In Chapter 13, that's pretty easy for most people because you don't usually get paid by anything other than a Chapter 13 plan, and the trustee really doesn't take payments until after the filing fee is paid. They just refund them to the debtor, and the debtor pays them the filing fee. In the 7, you just have to make sure that you don't collect anything post-petition, I don't know how some attorneys do it. I imagine how they do it is they're collecting money from the clients and then paying the filing fee with it, and then once the filing fee is paid, they'll just keep collecting money for themselves on however they've been doing it for the rest of the post-petition. But that gets to be the filing fee and installments is one of those things as well that's a little bit interesting with how you can set that all up, too. Go ahead. Or whoever.
I'm
to not allow the unbundling of reaffirmation, representation, and advice discussed?
We're 8 years in from BAPSIPA, and I remember sitting in many Lou Jones breakfasts arguing about the little signer signing waiver that lawyers had to sign at the bottom of reaffirmation agreements and how it was, the sky was falling. And I've been signing those for 8 years. I represent clients on reaffirmation agreements all the time. I just explain it to them. I tell them, you want to sign it, do you not want to sign it? They decide. I give them a letter. I cover my own back. And you sit there in a situation where I don't understand why you wouldn't necessarily. I mean, it unburdens the court a lot. Because they don't have to have a ton of needless hearings on things that you should be able to decide with your client. I mean, the only important thing is do your budget, look at your budget, tell your client, I think you can afford this, I don't think you can afford this, explain. It's the same thing the judge does, only you get to do it impersonally with the client and write down whatever you want.
Judge, is it common for Chapter 7 debtors to represent themselves with regard to reaffirmation agreements?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hesitancy on behalf of most lawyers that I've seen now isn't so much that little signing statement now, or the problem I run into all the time is dealing with the creditors is kind of a lot of fun lately, especially when you don't know who they are. And the effects and non-effects of reaffirming debt is huge now. So let's say I list a car in the bankruptcy and I say, I need a reaffirmation agreement. Crickets. I need a reaffirmation agreement. Still crickets. Well, I'm representing a debtor. What do I do now? Or better yet, my client signs one that they send me. I send it back to them, and they don't file it because I don't have their signature on it. I would file it myself if they would sign it, but it takes two people to agree to a reaff, and that's the biggest problem I have. And, I mean, I'm sure you guys see it all the time when the debtors come in on these reaffs and they want to do whatever. I mean, you can't get – the creditors are – I affectionately like to say stupid, not evil, when it comes to things like this. They don't give you stuff. Some first mortgage companies don't give you reaffs. Some first mortgage companies demand reaffs. We can hound them and hound them and hound them, but after a while, I send a letter to clients saying we've sent five letters to them. They haven't responded. Here you go. That's where we're at. You don't owe a personal obligation. Keep paying the payments.
Jane?
But it's tax deductible for a daycare.
All right, why don't we move on to section number 5, meritorious claims and contentions. And this relates to Supreme Court Rule 3.1. And generally, it requires lawyers to inform themselves about the facts of their clients' cases and the applicable law and determine that they can make a good faith argument in support of their client's position. Related to that Supreme Court rule, we have Bankruptcy Rule 9011. And 9011 provides that an attorney presenting a document to the court is certifying that the document is not being presented for an improper purpose, that the document contains claims, defenses, or legal contentions warranted by law or by a non-frivolous argument to modify current law, that the document contains allegations that will have evidentiary support, and that if the document is responsive, that it contains denials of factual allegations that are warranted on the evidence. I made a list of examples in bankruptcy law practice that implicate these rules, 9011 and the Supreme Court ethical rule. One of them is motions for relief from judgment or order under Rule 90-24, which implicates Federal Rule of Civil Procedure Rule 60, that do not allege sufficient grounds for relief. And what the court here has been seeing a lot of lately is motions to vacate dismissal orders. And Judge Kelly did a recent opinion on this issue, and she held that Rule 90-24 is an extraordinary remedy, and it's to be granted only in exceptional circumstances. So this begs the question, is the paper that you're filing, the motion, asking for something where you don't have insufficient reason to back that up? I mean, should you be filing such a motion? You know, with these motions to vacate dismissal, a lot of other questions are raised. Once a case is dismissed, you know, if there was no 341 meeting held yet, that's got to be rescheduled. Deadlines to object to dischargeability, you know, what happens with those now? Creditors receive notice of dismissal, and, you know, now the case is going to be active again. So what happens with any creditor action taken between the time of dismissal and reopening? So I don't know. I mean those are a lot of things you got to consider. And if you're going to file a motion like that, I mean, there's got to be, as Judge Kelly indicated, exceptional circumstances. Judge, do you have anything to add to that?
Where it's coming up is in a couple of places. One in Chapter 7 where they're trying to pay the filing fee in installments and they miss the installment or they don't get the fee paid by the end. We dismiss the case and then 2 weeks later or a month later or 2 months later they come in and they say, okay, I've got the fee now, reopen my case. And that was what had happened in Dorps. And the reason that she didn't pay the fee was because she got confused with whether she was paying her attorney fee or the filing fee to the court. And I said, that really isn't a good enough excuse. You're supposed to have sort of, if you read these cases on, if we call a motion to reconsider, and technically there's no such thing in the rules, but that's what everybody thinks of it. So you're asking the court to reconsider this order. Well, what is the reason you didn't comply with what the order said in the first place? Why didn't you pay the filing fee? I found a line of cases that said, it's got to be beyond the debtor's control. And sure enough, about the same time Dorf was pending, I had a debtor who said, I didn't pay my filing fee because a Social Security payment that has been coming like clockwork and I was counting on didn't come. It wasn't in her control. It wasn't I was confused or my lawyer didn't explain it to me right. It was something that I counted on wasn't coming. I let that get reconsidered. So we see it there in the 7. In the 13, we see the trustees move to dismiss. There's usually a stipulation. You all know how it goes. A doomsday on the payments, a doomsday on the tax returns, a doomsday on the refunds or the amended plan. The trustee gives all kinds of notice that they're enforcing this doomsday or they're, these are the reasons they want the case dismissed and nothing gets said. And the order gets entered and all of a sudden the client wakes up or the client just figures something out and it's motion to vacate the dismissal, motion to reconsider. I've given them the tax refunds and returns now. Here's the amended plan. I just filed it. This, in the 7, it's, I mean, I'm not going to say it's not bad, but it's much, much worse than the 13. Because between the time of that dismissal and the time of reinstating it, all kinds of stuff can have happened. You know, the trustee stopped the payroll order. The a creditor may have repossessed a car. A foreclosure may have gotten going. And what do you do in that gap period? So it's got to be something that you kind of have to be on top of before the case gets dismissed. I'm only speaking for myself, but I think all the judges feel the same. If you have any decent excuse for not getting the case dismissed, we'll try to give another chance. But once it's been dismissed, and now people have acted on that, it's hard. It's hard to unring that bell, and I'm not going to do it anymore. Unless it's an excuse that it's beyond the debtor's control. And I know they talk about excusable neglect. Well, if you read the cases on what's excusable neglect, it's not attorney error. It's not, please don't make my client suffer for my mistake. It's not. So it's sort of strict and it's sort of scary, but it will make the system function better without getting the case dismissed and then saying, oops, excusable neglect, reopen the case and let's get started again.
Judge, I'll add to that my office is pretty liberal. If you know that you've got a problem, you're not going to be able to file the amended plan by that due date, if you call my office, we'll put a note in the case.
We'll go back there after that, but this is going to take a while.
We'll put a note in the case saying that the plan is going to be 2 weeks late and we won't file the affidavit of default. But once we file it, then the judge has to deal with it.
Well, and I think that's basically where a lot of these come from is that it's a high volume practice and we all get dozens and dozens of motions. And I mean, even the most rigid system, something's going to slip through the crack. I mean, I swear probably once every 3 years we get one where we all of a sudden get a notice of no objection or an affidavit of no objection from usually Jay's office. I don't know why it always seems to be his every 3 years, but mostly because he files all the motions for relief. And I'll get this affidavit of no objection over ECF, and then all of a sudden we'll all be like, what motion? And we'll look, and it's nowhere. If we don't have an email record, we don't have anything of it. I mean, I don't know if it accidentally got deleted or how it came in, but it doesn't exist in my office. So the first thing you do is you file the objection. The second thing you do is you call Jay and you explain to him what it is. And, you know, most people don't want to punish people, especially if this is like your freak occurrence. I think the problem is the overuse of it more than anything else. I mean, I think if the judges saw you once every 3 to 5 years, maybe once possibly, they might look at it a little differently than when they're seeing you 6, 7, 8 times a year on the same thing where you're just blowing deadlines left and right and trying to reconsider. I also think it has something to do a little bit with time a lot of times as well. I mean, if you're trying to come back into the judge the day it gets dismissed with an emergency hearing like, oh my God, we screwed this up, judge, please don't, you know, whatever, it's a lot less risk. If you come back 2 months later, I mean, oftentimes I'll lose a client and 2 months later a client will call me and say, but I had all these money orders and we made all these payments, and it's like, can we go back to the judge? I mean, it's such a different world than where you were before. I mean, 2 months have gone by. No, I mean, they're never going to reinstate the case 2 months later, even with the original, even if you had the evidence that you made the payments, you know? You're just past that. I mean, where were you 2 months ago was the thing. But, I mean, that becomes a little bit of what it is as well. I mean, I don't think you have to be strict because otherwise people take the little bit of rope and hang themselves with it the longer it is.
Right. And, Mike, the other thing that we commonly think together, we understand Chapter 13 is a 3 to 5 year process. People change. People's lives change. People get lost. People's voicemails get full, and you can't contact the client. And here's a motion to dismiss from a client from a couple years ago or 18 months ago, and you can't get in touch with them to figure out whether they still want to stay in the case or they don't care anymore or they just, whatever. I get objections like that says, objection, I can't contact the client at a hearing. I would rather, and what I've been doing is issuing an order and saying, I'll give you 2 weeks to file an objection that has real grounds besides I can't find the client. Otherwise, I'm going to dismiss it. But the other way around that would be motion to extend the time to object. I can't find the client. I mean, to have a hearing when, and we all get on the phone or somebody has to come down to the courthouse over, I can't find the client. It seems like
And I'd be more than willing to do it. I think I'm the one who does that mostly. I think I pretty much object to every motion that comes out of this court. So,
Well, the other one is objections to the certificate of default or the affidavit of default because we can pay it now. No. You got the doomsday was your last chance. You don't get one more last chance because you can pay it now. And really, there should have been a Rule 60B motion for relief from the order before the dismissal or before the affidavit ever went through.
I mean, the reason we tend to bring those occasionally, judges, is that sometimes creditors, particularly mortgage creditors, are more persuaded by money than relief. And if we get to court, we know we're losing when we get to court. I mean, we know it's a lost cause when we get to court.
But so talk to the creditor, don't talk to us. So many of these things could be worked out so well without bothering the court. And we wish that would happen. And as you said, file the motion first, then call the creditor. You've got to do it the other way around. Call the creditor, and then you can file a stipulation. And if there could be a stipulation for relief from the order, you'd never see it. It would never get on our calendar. It wouldn't show up in the order or the docket activity report. Really, so much could be worked out.
A lot of times the answer to that phone call is file your objection and then we'll talk.
Well, that's stupid too.
But once the affidavit of default is filed, we don't know when you're going to sit down and sign that order.
In 7 days, typically.
Yes, and if you've got an objection to the affidavit of default because there is no default because I paid, that's grounds to object to an affidavit of default. If your objection is, oh, I know that we didn't pay client without a work, but we can pay now, that is no objection to an affidavit of default. As far as I'm concerned, that's a Rule 11 violation. Not that I always do it. But it is.
And
back to the
safe
harbor. And on. Especially, I look at the file, I see what they've paid, and most of a lot of times, they've paid in a lot of money, and they keep all the developers. I must have and they all lawyers know that. So in most cases, I've gone along with the debtor on that case, you know. It depends, but if you get a repetition of it, it's the same old story, the second time or third time, whatever it is, and out.
And are you pulling the retirement papers?
No.
And that's the difficulty as well, though. I mean, you get the client who's in month 55 and gets the affidavit of default over, we didn't file the amended plan on time to make it feasible. And they paid in, and it's at like 100% plan, but they just need to increase the payments or whatever. It's hard. I mean, you have to exercise some restraint, obviously. I mean, you. A lot of times.
Motion for relief from an order under 60B.
But if I file that motion, are we not going to sign the order on the affidavit dismissing the case?
No, if there's something pending.
Okay.
We don't get.
I mean, if that's the case, then I'm probably okay filing a request for relief from that order. That's fine with me. And I can get that denied.
And at least for Mary's office, if somebody objects to an affidavit of default, or if we filed an affidavit and they call up and say, hey, look, we made the payments, we just don't know, you know, why they didn't get to you, we'll definitely look into that. You know, we'll adjourn the hearing and look further into that situation. And if, in fact, you know, something out of the ordinary happened, we'll withdraw the affidavit.
Just a question. If I file that Rule 60 for you, but unfortunately I file it in a Judge Kelly case, am I in trouble under the Dorff standard for bringing a Rule 60?
No, you've got grounds to say this doomsday order, there's exceptional circumstances. They, you know, were 5 months from completion. They had some issue. Please don't enforce this provision of the doomsday order.
Or modify it to.
Modify the doomsday order. You know, in principle, I think in all likelihood the trustee would probably work with you on it. But that will be looked at a lot more kindly than just blow it off, let the case get dismissed, and now you're in trying to undismiss the case. Because at the point that she's talking about, and you're for relief from the doomsday order, the case is going on. All this terrible prejudicial parade of horribles hasn't happened.
and we can talk about it. My concern is once the case is dismissed, and all the creditors are notified, okay, the case is dismissed, and they move along.
They've written it off, they've changed their books.
Right.
Is that all sorts of things?
So again, the Rule 60 motion actually is going to the doomsday order,
not the dismissal of that case. I think you're much better off. Don't let it get dismissed and then try to get that vacated or reconsidered.
Right.
That's the bottom line we're suggesting.
Yes.
Try to stop it from being dismissed.
That's all we want, is time to work.
And we'll work with, that's what I tried to say. We'll work with you on that. I don't think the judges are that harsh on if some circumstance suggests that it shouldn't be dismissed. That's a lot easier to get us to do than it's dismissed, and now you want that reconsidered. After everybody's been notified, the trustee's been discharged,
the court summons has done all the work, and we've done all the work. It is a procedural nightmare to reinstate a Chapter 13. Unless it's something really extraordinary, and by the way, you didn't ask for dittos, but that's it. We don't want to reopen a case. We want to do everything possible before it gets dismissed.
Right, well, that was the purpose of those of us who file objections affidavit of default, but we'll just change that.
Don't do that.
To a 60.
Because you don't have valid grounds.
Well, I mean, it's
back to default.
We don't need. We usually add a line to our objection that says we're requesting relief from the doomsday provision under Rule 60, but I tend to put that in my objection to affidavits. When I know that I might have a little tweak on the doomsday, I add that line, but affidavit of default objections are kind of stock mostly. So.
And they are not kindly regarded, at least where I am. Don't have grounds to object to the default, I paid it, and that's the only ground, then that's it. But if you say, please change the doomsday so that you're not enforcing the doomsday, that's a separate motion. It'll be linked, I think, to the motion to dismiss, so we would not get the order anyway.
Okay.
I usually will not settle an objection to an affidavit of default if there has actually been a default. I want the
case
dismissed, and I will go to court for
that. Right. We know that. Some final thoughts? I think just from like a procedural perspective, if you're doing that motion to reconsider, you should make sure that it links back to the motion to dismiss.
Yeah, I think that would be the key, is if we link it into either the affidavit or the original or the order on the motion to dismiss.
Right, because otherwise it's not going to show up for the judges in their chambers as.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd file it the same way procedurally as you file the objection to the affidavit. You just would have a different motion with a different name and a different title, so it would show up as a motion for something. See, now you're gonna get those.
You wanted to point out you've got Tim Pierce's phone number there.
Yeah, if you do run across an ethical dilemma, at the end of the outline, there's a small section called What to Do If You Have an Ethics Issue. Tim Pierce is the person at the Wisconsin State Bar that you would want to call. His phone number is there. You can also request a formal opinion if you have something regarding prospective behavior. I guess if you have an issue like a Chapter 7 trustee, undisclosed asset issue that you want a formal opinion on, it's my understanding that you can write to the State Bar and try to get an answer from them in writing.
And feel free to share with the rest of us.
Great. Thank you so much, guys, for your presentation. Happy holidays. Judge McGarity and I are having a festivus. Celebration down in our courtroom. There will be the airing of the grievances followed by the feats of strength. So, mark with your grievances and your feats. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
See you next month.